Now, our speaker this morning is a man in great and high demand. But I knew we had a shot at getting Dr. Tim Keller here this morning when I was reading his best-selling book, The Reason for God, and I found at least three footnotes referencing the transcripts of these meetings. And I said, okay, Tim knows we exist, and he knows how serious the conversation is, and maybe he too would like to join us for a conversation. And then when I ran into him some time ago, he said, I need at least a year advance. And so I've done my best to make it happen. So he's the best-selling author of many books. He's also the pastor of Redeemer Presbyterian Church in Manhattan, which has been featured in the New York Times and the Washington, Wall Street Journal. His latest book is just out. It's on vocation and work, called Every Good Endeavor, which I highly commend to you. Every Good Endeavor, Connecting Your Work to God's Work. And this has been out maybe 2 months, right, Tim? So, ladies and gentlemen, you'll read the bio of Tim Keller in the packets that we've given you. I would just say that the topic we've given him, Conservative Christianity After the Christian Right, was suggested by one of the advisors to this event, your friend and our colleague, Barbara Bradley Haggerty of NPR. She said at a luncheon that we have about 4 months out before the event, I really want you to try to get Tim Keller and tell him to address the question, Conservative Christianity After Christian Right, whereupon then Barbara was not able to join us for the meeting. But I still think it's a great topic. And Tim readily agreed to the topic. So, Tim, we're grateful for you taking the time, because I do know how, we all know how busy you are, and thank you for coming.
Okay. You know, I'm Conservative Christianity After the Christian Right.
Yep.
I am used to speaking about things that I am absolutely certain of. I am used to speaking about things I would take a bullet for and things I would die for. I would like the record to show that I'm not willing to die for my opinion on Conservative Christianity After the Christian Right. As would just like everyone to see that, because this feels like surmise all the way down. But you're journalists, and that's what you do. You surmise, and I'm surmising with you. It's not totally stupid. The reason I said yes, it's not stupid to ask me about this, because first of all, I'm old enough that I was a conservative Protestant Christian before there was a Christian right. I was raised in a kind of a liberal Lutheran church, the LCA, the old LCA, Lutheran Church in America. I became a Christian and therefore, and an evangelical one at that, during college by reading John Stott books and C.S. Lewis books, that sort of thing. And at that time, if you were a theological conservative, it didn't mean you were a political conservative. So I predate the wedding of those two things. And now the other thing is, many of you know, the church that I pastor and have pastored for quite a while, it was interesting to see Luis's presentation was great. But when he shows me the millennials, what a high percentage of them are unaffiliated, and then the next, you know, the 18 to 29, then the next, those are the people that are there. My church is average, about 32 is the median age, which makes it about 80% under 42 or something like that. And so I live in that world that is totally allergic to institutional religion, and I live amongst what you have to call younger evangelicals. And so it just as well I do speak to this, I guess, because I'm old enough and my church is young enough that maybe I can say something about it. I should also, here's some definitions. Number one, I'm actually a conservative Protestant, as you know, not a conservative Christian only, and conservative Roman Catholics and Orthodox folks, I'm not going to be able to, actually, I'm not a scholar here. I'm here as a practitioner. And as a practitioner, I don't feel like I know enough about those worlds and their numbers and the issues to talk much about them. So about 80% of what I say is really going to fit more conservative Protestant Christianity. So actually, it should say conservative Protestant Christianity After the Christian Right, because that's mainly what I'm going to talk about. Even though conservative Roman Catholics and conservative Protestants really overlap in so many of their values, and they'd have so many, they could make common cause in so many areas. Nevertheless, I'll make reference to them, but I'm basically thinking about Protestants. Secondly, what is a conservative Protestant? I'll use the Bebington 4 plus 1. Now, David Bebington was a sociologist, a British sociologist some years ago, that try to define evangelicalism and came up with these four. I mean, I haven't found the autograph of what he actually said because it keeps coming down through everybody else, but this is my understanding, his four characteristics were the authority of the Bible. By that, I think it means the Bible as trumps reason and experience. Secondly, the necessity of conversion, of a conversion experience of some kind. Thirdly, salvation through faith in Christ's work on the cross, not good works. Fourth, mission, the idea of activism, needing to take this message to the world. And my fifth one I would add, just that even though it may be inherent, it may be implied, I would call it supernatural Christianity. Liberal Christianity tried to redo all of Christian doctrine in terms of naturalistic assumptions, no miracles. And I would say, no, I mean, to me, an evangelical Pentecostal conservative Protestant definitely believes in miracles, believes the resurrection really happened. Somebody once told me, if you ask an Episcopalian minister, did the resurrection really happen? And if he says, well, it depends on what you mean, that means no. So a conservative Protestant says, he asks, did the resurrection really happen? And he says, yes. And other people say, well, it depends on how you look at it. So, in fact, Andrew Del Banco, who I really respect, secular Jewish professor of humanities at Columbia University. One time I was on a panel with him, and he was trying to figure out where I was. And I was trying to say, and he says, oh, I get it. You don't take the Apostles and Nicene Creed metaphorically, do you? I said, bingo, that's it. I don't take it. Okay, conservative Protestantism. And who are they? I would say, I really appreciate what Louis said yesterday, that if you back out what I would call the soft part of evangelicals, which would be you have some big denominations like Southern Baptist and Missouri Synod Lutheran Church that are so large that they're actually, I think, experiencing a lot of the nominalism and the disaffiliation that mainline churches are experiencing. But then you have to back in the churches and people in the mainline that are really evangelical. You back them in, you back them out, it comes out about the same. The 7% of black Protestants, regardless of what else you know, the vast majority of them would fit the Bebbington 4 plus 5. There is just no doubt about it. So that gets you right now to almost 30% of the population, or close. Less than a third, more than a quarter. And that's what I want to talk about. And so I'd like to give you three things that I think I'm fairly confident of, at street level, admittedly, fairly confident will happen in the future. Okay? And then I'd like to talk to you about some things that might happen in the future that could move the needle either way. So first of all, three things that I'm fairly confident of happening. And I'll actually read you these three things and then go through them. So I'm down here. One is that conservative Protestant Christianity is going to be growing moderately in numbers and greatly in cultural diversity and racial diversity in a fragmented culture. Secondly, I'll repeat them. Conservative Protestant Christianity is going to become consciously outside the box politically, but not consciously outside the box theologically. And thirdly, it's going to get both more and less culturally influential at once, with the end result in doubt. Okay, number one, when I say growing moderately, Luis pointed out whereas the devout people in the country, and over here the secular people, where the big change is, the erosion is in the middle. The devout numbers are not actually going down that much. It depends on how you read them. They're not in free fall by any means. What I think is fair, and I'm really glad I can actually come in, hopefully this will be really driven in everybody's psyche, because I'll basically say the same thing Louise said, that you don't so much see secularization as polarization, and what's really coming away is the middle. Now, for example, here's what this means. It's actually very important for what's happening right now. It used to be that the devout and the mushy middle, nominal Christians, people that would identify as Christians, people would come to church sporadically, people would certainly respect the Bible and Christianity. The devout and the mushy middle together was a supermajority of people who just created a kind of Christian-y sort of culture. Now, what's happening is that erosion, and Luis is right in saying lots and lots of unaffiliated people are not atheists or agnostics. But what's happened is it used to be the mushy middle used to be more identified with the devout. Now it's more identified with the secular. That's all. So what's happening is the roof has come off for the devout. The devout had a kind of a shelter, an umbrella. You couldn't be all that caustic toward traditional kind of classic Christian teaching and truth. I mean, I spoke on Friday morning to the American Bible Society's board. American Bible Society does a lot of polling about the Bible. I don't know why, but and the use of the Bible, reading the Bible, attitudes toward the Bible. They said the very same thing that I heard from Luis, that actually the number of people who are devout Bible readers is not changing that much. What is changing is, for the first time in history, a growing group of people that think the Bible's bad, it's dangerous, it's regressive, it's a bad cultural force. That was just never there. It's very tiny. And that's because the middle ground has shifted, so it's more identified, I'm sorry, with, I don't know which, should I be left, right on this? It's more identified with the more secular, the less religious, and it's less identified now with the more devout. I don't know why. You know, Luis has to, you know, because he's a scientist, he's not supposed to give too many ideas about where all these trends came from and what is going to happen next. But I have no such... I have no handcuffs on me. I can pontificate all that I want. That's what I am. I'm a pontiff. I would say I'm pontificating away. Yes.
Presbyterian pontiff.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we have them. Calvin thought there was no problem with Presbyterian bishops, by the way, just to let you know. I can prove that. Oh, that's right. This is not off the record, is it? All right. I would say, to try to understand what's going on, if you go to a guy like, you go to Robert Bella, or you go to Charles Taylor, you go to the people that say that what's happening now is expressive individualism, like Charles Taylor calls it exclusive humanism, and it's the fruit of the Enlightenment. And the Enlightenment said that my reason, not trumped by revelation or tradition or anything else, is the way I'm going to find truth. It was interesting. Luc Ferry, who's a French philosopher, has written, you know, a book of his. I can't read French, so I can only read stuff that's translated. He wrote a book called A Brief History of Thought. And he actually says that that idea, that individual consciousness and reason is the arbiter of truth, he says, is actually like an acid that eats through its own container. In other words, what it does is it not only eats away at tradition and religion, but it actually eats away at everything. It eats away at all institutions. It eats away at anything that is going to trump my sovereign and sacred ability to decide what is right or wrong for me. And so that's the one side. And on the other side, there's the sociology of knowledge approach, which says, yes, social media and mobility and, you know, the iPod, all those things. I mean, the iPod was the death of the music industry, and the idea that I have to get an album. And the idea that I should come to a conference, a concert, and sit down and listen to all four, you know, movements of the symphony, even the part that I find boring. So all that's going away. So you can do the sociology knowledge side, you can do a history, you know, intellectual history side. For whatever reason, the center is coming off. And the people who are able to overcome the acids of individualism, you might say, are people that have to be really devout now. It's just not enough to simply say, I go to church, I'm, you know, my father was Methodist and my grandfather's Methodist, so I'm a Methodist. I don't go to church very often. That's just all gone away. Now, here's why I think probably two things about this. That conservative Protestantism will grow moderately or stay. But I think it'll grow. Now, here's the reason why. I'm going to be a little optimistic. First of all, as we have already seen, it's white people mainly that are getting more secular in the world. White people, just keep that in mind, since most of you are. And there's a tendency,
most
of the people right here are, yeah, I'm sorry, let the transcript show, I'm talking about the people in the room. And there's a tendency for us to think, like, you know, it's just impossible not to overcome this practically, that, you know, we're reality. And because so many of our people are getting more and more, you know, secular and unaffiliated and so forth, this is the way the world's going, and it's just not true. I understand that by 2050, maybe only 30% of the world will be white. something like that. So white people are definitely getting more secular. Now, I am in a spot where I've seen, for reasons I'll tell you in, under my second heading here, that I've seen a lot of disaffected Anglo-type people who have, you know, gone off to college, decided I can't find a Christianity or a faith that really works for me, and then gets recaptured by Redeemer and churches in Manhattan. I can see that, and I do see, I don't know how statistically significant it is, maybe it's not much, but I do know we can hold our own with that crowd. I just know it can be done. We actually did a survey a couple years ago in which we looked at inside the center of New York City, which is Manhattan, south of the top of Central Park, and maybe extreme western New Jersey and extreme western Queens and Brooklyn. As many of you know, that's the sort of professional core of the city. It's about 1,050,000 people. We went through there, and as generously as possible, windshield survey, tried to identify every evangelical-ish Protestant church. And we, like I said, when I said evangelical-ish, I mean, we were pretty fairly generous in our, the Bevington 4 or 5. And also how many Manhattan residents go to those churches. And it took a lot of work, but we realized that in 1989, there were about 100 of those churches, about 9,000 Manhattan residents in it, which is less than 1% of the population. And in 2009, there was about 200 of those churches. My church helped start about a third of them. And there is now 34,000 Manhattan residents in those churches. Now, from one side, you know, that's a big uptick. From another side, it's still a fringe phenomenon. Nevertheless, it means holding your own or something like that. However, the reason why I still think that evangelicalism or maybe conservative Protestantism is going to probably hold its own and grow is because of the rise of global Christianity. Many of those folks are coming here, especially in the city. So some real quicks, and these are, I don't totally trust any, I trust, when I read about 10 different versions of religious statistics and the fact that they kind of converge, then I can give you I trust that. And so here's what I do know. Korea, in 100 years, went from about 0 to 40% Christian. Africa, in 100 years, from 1900 to 2000, went from 9% to about 50% Christian. China is probably on a 100-year trajectory to do about the same thing, probably go from about 2 or 3% to maybe 30 or so. By the way, that's going to change history of the world right there, because some of you may know China's a little bigger than Korea. And as of course, not as troubled as Africa, and so there's already more Pentecostal evangelical Christians in China than there are in all the United States. So now, what does that mean? It means that Christianity is growing in these non-Western places at 7 to 10 times the population in many cases, and they're coming to Western cities. The biggest churches by far in London right now are African churches. And what happened in New York, very interesting. In 1965, the Bronx, Brooklyn, and Queens were largely, outside of black Protestants, it was basically a Catholic-Jewish place. There was a few scattered mainline churches, and that was about it. You know, there's been an enormous influx, and there are now almost certainly 10% of all New Yorkers, out of the 8 million New Yorkers, 10% are Pentecostal Christians. My son is a urban planner, works for the city of New York. He's a city planner. He says, when you go to Manhattan community boards, they are very secular. But if you go out into the Bronx and Queens and Brooklyn, places like that, he says, community boards, and you know what a community board is. It's a, you know, it's a public, you know, it's where zoning decisions get made. It's half the community boards are appointed by the mayor and things like that. He says they're open and closed in prayer, especially in the Bronx, because it's all led by black and Latino Pentecostal ministers. They're the community leaders, and we guess that 12 to 15% now of the Bronx, Queens, and Brooklyn are probably what we call Bevington 5, Pentecostal or evangelical. Now, what happens is those folks are very ethnic. They're not from the Eastern Southern Europe, which is what used to dominate America, New York. It's from the Eastern Southern Hemisphere. And when they come, they win their own folks, and they grow, and they plant tons and tons of churches. And then when their kids grow up, go to college, learn to speak English, they come into the center. And that's why if you go into Redeemer, you'll see we're only about 43% white. Redeemer's 5,000 or 6,000 people coming. It's very 15% of the people who go to Redeemer either have their doctorate or are working on it. Out of the 6,000, it's 70% single. It's pretty unusual, and it's still a fringe phenomenon. Actually, it's not. It hasn't captured the cultural imagination. But the fact is that to a great degree, we are fueled by lots and lots of people who have actually been won to faith in ethnic churches. They need a way of migrate. They need to get a kind of religion and Christianity that helps them figure out what it means to be a Christian in the dominant culture. And very often, some of the ethnic churches can't do that. A good quick example of this was some years ago, I had three Korean pastors from Queens come to see me, and they sat down. They weren't hostile at all. They just said, you know, a lot of our Korean folks, boys and girls who were raised in Korea, in our churches, go off to college. They stop going to church, but now they're showing up at your church. Why? And I said, I can tell you. I said, you're Korean, so you're not individualistic. So when they come and when their kids are growing up and they come and they say to you, why should we be Christian? You say to them, because we're a Christian family, because we're a Christian people, because, you know, they give a collectivistic answer, you know, all right? But then they send them off to Harvard, Yale, and Princeton, and they will go to Harvard, Yale, and Princeton if you're Korean. And, you know, or else you work harder. And then they come out, but they're now not Asian American. They're not just Asian; they're Asian American. They're still more collectivistic. In other words, they're not like white people, but they're not just like their parents either. And so basically, they come to Redeemer, where I don't assume any other. I give people reasons. I give them individual reasons. I say Christianity makes emotional sense, Christianity makes cultural sense, and Christianity makes rational intellectual sense too. But unless you can show them the first two, nobody's going to sit around to ask, you know, what's the evidence for the resurrection. So we have a way of doing that that, you know, helped a lot of people make the jump. Not everybody makes the jump. But the point is that there's this, like I said, white people are getting smaller in numbers. The country is getting more multi-ethnic. Non-white people tend to be more communal, less individualistic. My non-white members are way more respectful of me as a pastor than my white members. Way more. It's unbelievable. It is unbelievable. You know, white people, I say, you know, what are you doing? You know, and everybody else is pastor. Now we'll get back to that. Anyway, so the point is, but here's the point. The point is that evangelical Pentecostal churches are the most, as far as I know, right now, the most multi-ethnic human institutions in the world. They do bring together white people, black people, Hispanic people, and Asian people better than Pentecostal evangelical churches don't do that as well. We tend to be Asian Anglo. Right on the ground, if you're not into charismatic worship, basically Anglo-Asians and black Hispanics tend to do well at choose. They can mix well because they like the same kind of choices, they like the same kind of music. But if you are Pentecostal, it just brings the whole thing together. But increasingly, the evangelical Pentecostal communities are going to be, they're going to be led by non-white people. They're going to have a lot of moral authority because of that. I see basically conservative Protestantism in this country is growing slowly, but not much, not a great deal, but it's not, the needle's not going down to zero. Or not down to 5% or 2%. It's not going the European direction, at least not in the next generation or two. Okay, number one. Number two, I said consciously, outside the box politically, but not theologically. And it's because of what I'm going to call the inertia of the Bible. That's a new term, and I just made it up last night. So I want you to know, if it ever becomes au courant, you'll say, I was there. Except the more I think about it, the more I don't think it's going to go anywhere. But anyway, here's what I mean. First of all, it is true that younger evangelicals are not wedded that much to the Christian right. To me, the Christian right was conservative politics, which would mean smaller government, lower taxes, strong national defense, a pretty high value on free market capitalism, along with, I mean, to me, the Christian right was that, along with sort of traditional 2,000-year-old Christian values of, you know, anti-abortion, no easy divorce, homosexuality is wrong. And you put that together, you have the Christian right. Now, there is no doubt that on the economic and political side, that younger evangelicals just are not as wedded to the high value of the free market, super strong national defense, or small government. I mean, they are very sensitive to issues of what they would call justice and the needs of the poor, and if they see public policies that don't seem to take that into effect, they're not happy. It's also true, here's this, is conservative politics tends to say that race isn't a big problem anymore. But you see, increasing numbers of evangelicals are not, they're not white. And even my Asian members, of which we have many, who have gone off to Harvard, Yale, and Princeton, come back and have great jobs in the city and so on, they know race is an issue. I mean, in other words, it just doesn't make any sense to non-white people to say, well, we're past that. We don't have to pay any attention to it in public policy anymore, which seems to be what they hear from conservatives. So because so many evangelicals, and the younger evangelicals are multi-ethnic, you know, they're not, so many are not white, because of their concerns about you know, justice and the poor, they do perceive the conservatism as being kind of clueless and heartless to some degree. However, have put it on this side. However, I don't believe, in spite of the fact that there's a very small number of very shrill people saying, I'm evangelical and I think homosexuality is all right, the vast majority of younger evangelicals are not going to change theologically or in the, I just don't see the needle moving in the area of the social issues. I see it in the political issues. And here's what I mean by the inertia of the Bible. Because of the cacophony of voices about what the Bible means now, and I've never heard anything like it in my whole life, how many people are arguing over you know, how to interpret the Bible. And there's so many voices out there saying you can get any... A lot of people just throw up their hands. If you're not really reading the Bible through, you throw up your hands and say, who's to say? There's no way to interpret it. Anybody can get anything out of it they want. But if you actually read the Bible... And that's my job. I read it, and I work through with lay people who read it all the time. I'd say about 20% of the Bible is really not very easy to understand. In other words, when you read it, it just doesn't make much sense. It takes background. It's questionable. There's people who have different views. But if you take the 80% that actually is relatively clear, especially if you both liberal and conservative commentators say, here's what the author meant, it's not that hard to tell what the author was getting at. And the 80%... Actually, I would say the Bible comes out looking kind of like Catholic social theory or African Americans' way of reading it. Why? Because on the one hand, there's a lot of emphasis on the poor and redistribution of wealth. And in spite of what I really don't think it's that hard to make the case, in spite of the Old Testament Holy War stuff, by and large, you read the Bible canonically all the way through Old and New Testament as a Christian, and there's an awful lot of emphasis on peacemaking. It's very hard to get, I think, nationalism out of the Bible, especially when nationalism is constantly being, you know, undermined, especially in the New Testament. And even the old, you know, I mean, the way the Christian understanding of the Old Testament was that, you know, the people of God existed as a nation state for a period of time. And now the people of God is actually a kind of multi-ethnic international fellowship. And so at that point, that's why Jesus says, rendered unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, God's the things that are God's. It's a change in saying Christians don't exist as a nation state anymore, and they shouldn't exist as a nation state anymore. That you're a Christian first, and you're white or black or Asian or Hispanic second. You're Christian first, and you're from Ohio or Pennsylvania or Texas second. And when you do that, and I think that's what Ephesians is all about, and when you start to read the Bible through, on the one hand, it looks liberal in those areas. It's not great on nationalism. It's not great on keeping all your money for yourself. It's big, big, big on helping the poor. But on the other hand, it's really very clear on marriage and sex and stuff like that. The only, there's seven times the Bible mentions homosexuality. It's always negative. The Bible opens and closes with a heterosexual marriage. Everybody knows when you read it, it privileges heterosexuality. I mean, it's very obvious. So I think that basically the common sense reading of the Bible is going to bring you out, and this is the inertia, of not really being, I don't think, the Christian right, but on the other hand, really not becoming liberal Protestants either. I mean, there's a tendency to say, where evangelicals going? I think they're going to look more and more politically, actually, like conservative Roman Catholics. And I think they're also, and like African Americans. I think that's where they're going. But the inertia of the Bible keeps them from, I think, being, here, let me just, one last thing, getting really very liberal when it comes to theology and social ethics. And let me just give you a good example of this. Jonathan Rauch, am I saying his name right? Is it Rauch?
Rauch.
See, that's the problem. I don't live in your world. See, I just study the Bible and preach my certainty. So I don't know everybody's, I don't know how to pronounce anybody's name, really.
You need to visit more often.
I know, I will. Jonathan Rauch in The Advocate 2 years ago made a really good point. As you all know, he would certainly be a gay activist. He says, gay people believe that to say homosexuality is a sin is just as bigoted as saying black people are inferior. It's the same thing. He says, then here's the problem. If you go to the Quran and the Old Testament and the New Testament, even though racists can get, you know, you can get anything you want out of any text. That's to some degree true. But he says, white supremacy is not a core teaching of the Bible, no matter how you read it. You just can't get white supremacy out of there. It's, you know, there's people who find this or that or, you know, it's just not there, all right. He says, on the other hand, it's really pretty obvious that the Bible has a problem with homosexuality. So he says, you might want to say that both these views are equally bigoted, but on the one hand, you can go to Christians with white supremacy and say you're not being true to your own Bible. What I was trying to say yesterday in response to Rule is the way to be persuasive is not just to beat on people from the outside, but to come inside. To say, if you're trying to change an Islamic person's practice, you go inside and say, you're not being true to your own beliefs, to your own Islam. That's what you do. So David Chappell, who wrote a book called A Stone of Hope, which is about the civil rights movement, says it's amazing how fast broad backing for segregation in the South collapsed. When you went and you said, you're not being true to your own beliefs. I remember I got to my church in Hopewell, Virginia, a little blue-collar church in 1975. And some of my older people, even though they had been, segregation had been in the town almost up to like 5 years before that. But most of my older people said, you know, I'm embarrassed that we were part of that. It's amazing how fast it collapsed. But to a great degree, it's because you can't get white supremacy out of the Bible very easily. But Jonathan Rauch says, the problem is, if you say to everybody, anyone who thinks homosexuality is a sin is a bigot, he says, you're going to have to ask them to completely disassemble the way in which they read the Bible, completely disassemble their whole approach to authority. You're basically going to have to ask them to completely kick their entire faith out the door. And he says, that's not going to happen very fast. Now, he hopes it happens eventually. He did say that. But he says, to think that in two or three decades, the needle, you know, how many white supremacists are there anymore that are really out there? Not many. And to think that the same thing is going to happen about reservations of homosexuality is just, it's just la-la land. Now, I think what Jonathan is saying has been ignored, actually. Certainly been ignored by the media. Aren't you the media? So don't ignore it. That's what I'm here to tell you. But you see, I'm saying there's an inertia in the Bible that I think allows a person to get a lot of leeway on politics. You know, you can be politically, economically, kind of liberal, conservative. There's a whole lot of ways of going, but it doesn't give you a whole lot of leeway on those social issues and your basic theology. Lastly, I think that conservative Protestant Christianity is going to get both more and less culturally influential at the same time, and this is going to be a problem. Here's why. On the one hand, I was talking to at lunch yesterday. I'm old enough to know that the basic discourse inside evangelical and Pentecostal churches, not so much the Pentecostal, but certainly non-Pentecostal churches, has really shifted. Because 30 years ago, the expectation was this: if you're really sold out for Jesus, you'll go into the ministry or the mission field. If you're not sold out for Jesus, just get a job and give us the money because we're doing the Lord's work. Right. That's utterly changed. Totally changed.
There's a book about that, right?
Well, yeah. Yeah, see, I'm opportunistic. Well, actually, the first chapter of the book, which ended up not ever getting in there, I started to do research on. There's a huge movement inside conservative Protestantism right now to say the best thing you can possibly do with your faith is just go get a job and be a thoughtful, non-triumphalistic, but also non-assimilated Christian in the major cultural industries. Did you hear that? It's a very powerful movement that says the best thing you can do is not try to take over. Not try to take over the country. After all, you know, we're not supposed to be a Christian nation. All right? Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's. We don't do that. We're a pluralistic nation. On the other hand, we don't want to just assimilate. We you know, the Bible gives us views of human nature and human thriving and human good and the purpose of life that are very different than the secular. So go out there and get involved very, you know, and be very thoughtful Christians in your job. Serve other people, but do it on the basis of what your own understandings are, your own moral intuitions are, and integrate your faith with your work, and in a non-triumphalistic way, but a non-assimilationist way, get out there. And, you know, you have to ask the question, if Tribe X, if thousands and thousands of young people from Tribe X get into Hollywood trying to make it in the movies, how many thousands have to try to get in at the bottom for there to be one Tribe X Steven Spielberg?
What is Tribe X?
Tribe X. Tribe, T-R-I-B-E, X. Tribe X. Some group.
Oh, Tribe X. Okay.
Some group. Some ethnic group, religious group. What?
Oh, Tribe X.
How many? I know. Well, actually, guess what? See, listen, they couldn't follow me either, but they, you know, they're journalists, so they look like they would. Everybody knows all journalists always go like this to everybody they interview. It's amazing. Yeah. Understanding and general positive regard.
No, I intuited that they
inside,
did not know
no.
what it was. That's why my job as moderator is to
okay.
speak for them when they're not speaking.
Sure. So how many of a particular group of people would have to be trying to get into Hollywood, you know, the Darwinian thing happens, and who makes it to the top of the food chain? I don't know, but I think, frankly, my guess is critical mass of evangelicals for the first time in modern history are trying to get into those various cultural industries now. Peter Berger, in one of your Faith Angle transcripts, talked about that as one of what he thought it was very, very, very significant. He said, if the evangelicals become assimilated, then they'll just become like everybody else, which they might. They might. There's a lot of pressure out there. On the other, and if they're triumphalistic, they'll be just thrown out. In other words, if they just start to beat people over the head with the Bible, they just get thrown out. But it's possible that it might have a big effect, and it might. And I do think there is, I don't know how to say it, something like that going on out there.
We had Michael Flaherty was coming to this event, and he had a family emergency come up at the last minute, and Michael would comment immediately on this.
Maybe, yeah. But now, when I say that's on the one hand. On the other hand, as I mentioned, the roof came off. That is, you had the devout, you had the secular, and you had that middle ground that made it hard to speak disrespectfully of traditional values. That middle ground now has not so much gone secular, but they more identified with a side. They're identified with expressive individualism, and so they don't want to tell anybody how to live their lives. And so what that means now, of course, is that the devout suddenly realize that they are out there, that the umbrella is gone, and they are taking a lot of flack for their views. It's just public flack. And there was no doubt, by the way, the Louis Giglio thing when he was sort of disinvited because of his traditional views on homosexuality from giving the invocation at the inauguration, that was so clear. No matter how I add it up, I look at the mainline churches and I take out the quarter that are probably evangelical. My guess is that 80% of the clergy of this country would have some reservations about homosexuality, 75-80%, something like that. But what we were being told was that you're beyond the pale. Not just that you're wrong, but that respect for you is wrong. You know that, and so that was that was heard loud and clear in the conservative Protestant world. Loud and clear. It was enormously discouraging. It was sort of a sense of, okay, so it's not just that you're going to disagree with us, but basically you're saying you know, we really don't even have a right to be in the public square. That's pretty. So when you have, on the one hand, that kind of pushback in the public square, because now the middle is with the secular rather than with the devout, you have both more people from conservative Protestantism trying to get into the cultural industries than ever before, instead of just staying out and being in their own subculture. On the other hand, getting more pushback for their views than ever. What will happen? I would think if you were in the media, you would say, this is a story, and I'm just going to have to keep an eye on it. I don't think that right now there's a tension between people wanting influence and people wanting to have less influence, and the end result is in doubt. Now, lastly, and briefly, I said there are some things that might be able to break things in a... I said my belief is the conservative Protestant Christianity is going to stay where it is, pretty much, or grow a bit. I think it's not going to become less influential. It's going to be more embattled, I suppose. But there are some things that could move the needle in a pretty good way. The one thing that, for example, when New York Magazine wrote a snarky article, because they write only snarky articles, about Redeemer some years ago, they said it was kind of striking. I mean, in other words, the reporter came in and was kind of shocked by the number of... They expected, first of all, a small evangelical church in a place like Manhattan, and secondly, they expected people that really weren't Manhattanites. But they walked around and they said, wait a minute, this is us. But they did say, this is a fringe phenomenon. I've already quoted them a couple of times, and it's stayed in my head. This is a fringe phenomenon. Now, as some of you know, the speech act thing, speech act theory thing, it says that was a illocutionary hope. In other words, to say it's a fringe phenomenon, you could just tell what the reporter was trying to say was, I'm hope. It was a marginalizing comment. It was something of a way of saying, I hope that this stays a fringe phenomenon. But it's also, and by calling it a fringe phenomenon, I'm helping it stay a fringe phenomenon. But he's also right, because honestly, 3% of the population isn't, it's, to me, if something captures the cultural imagination, the needle really starts to move, it means it gets to 15, 20, 25%. I don't know if that's going to happen, but it could happen if a couple things happen. Number one, something outside, usually. Korea went from 0 to 40% Christian, partly because it was a cultural problem that a lot of people felt. And it was the Japanese domination and the humiliation that the Koreans felt, and the very idea that their way of life wasn't working. And in some ways, Christianity filled a vacuum. And I think Christianity, because I believe it's true, on its own merits will always have a great appeal. It's never going to go away. It's always going to have a lot of appeal. But when it really starts to take, revivals happen. Because not only has the church got some vitality, but something happens out in the culture that creates a vacuum. And a lot of people look at it who wouldn't otherwise. I'm not sure what's going on in China. I've heard that ever since Tiananmen... I mean, when I've gone to China and talked to Christians there, they said they thought for a lot of younger people, Tiananmen Square kind of... the scales fell from their eyes and they realized socialism isn't necessarily the just system we thought it was. And as one person said, he says, everybody my age after Tiananmen Square, one-third became Christian, one-third just tried to get out, and one-third just tried to make money. And, and it says about 5% now are still true believers in socialism. So something has to happen.
Yeah, Rob covers China for the economy.
In the culture for there to be, a kind of major change. And so I don't know whether something like that's going to happen in America or not. I don't foresee anything. But if there's some kind of upheaval, very often it really helps religion. It is, frankly, stability and materialism that, and material prosperity that tends to not help it so much. But on the church side...
Did that happen at Redeemer after 9/11?
Oh, well, that doesn't count. Yes, of course. What happened at Redeemer, just quick, but I'm trying to be done at 10, and so you're not helping. Well, what happened at Redeemer? Redeemer, unlike a lot of churches, is very... Well, it's answering the question. One of the things the church has to do is it has to learn how to reason differently. As I have already said, you have to connect to baseline cultural narratives. You have to say that Christianity is better than secularism at dealing with cultural difference. I'll give you an example of that. It's better at making sense out of suffering. It's better at actually giving you a basis for human rights and justice. You have to learn to go inside and say, these are things you want, but I'll tell you something, Charles Taylor's great book, Secular Age, says secularism actually doesn't have the resources, it doesn't have the intellectual resources to support many of its own commitments. You've got to learn how to say that in more accessible language. And if you learn how to reason, not just say Jesus will make you happy, but on the other hand, not just beat on people from the outside, but come inside their own beliefs, find their own cultural narratives, and say, look, Christianity can... Your life narrative will only have a happy ending in Jesus. You know, whatever your narrative is, there's no happy ending except in Jesus. There's a way of doing that, and a lot of churches don't know how to do it. I think if they do that, they're going to get a lot of traction. Secondly, you've got to pull off creating real communities that at least take seriously the fact that people are individualists. So, for example, and I'll still get to 9/11 in a second. For example, in a typical traditional, for example, somebody once told me, I had a Korean pastor once. We have a large church, you know, and have a big staff. So when I was in a meeting, if we had a decision to make, we would talk. After one of the meetings, a Korean pastor says, you know, in a Korean church, if we had a decision to make, the first person to speak would be the senior pastor. He would say, here's what I think. The next person would be the next senior person, and then down from the senior pastor down to the youngest. So by the time the youngest person spoke, all you're doing is just saying, yay, to what everybody else has said. In other words, basically, the first person that speaks is the authority, and he basically sets the framework. And then everybody else just tweaks it until you get down to the bottom, and all you can do is cheer. He says what he noticed was in our church that I spoke last because I knew that people, and I, what I would do is I'd mask my views because I was really trying to bring out what everybody was trying to say. And then it was my job to be an arbiter between them, to try to find the solution that I knew would have the greatest amount of ownership. Because I was the only one with the capital to say, look, seven of you want this, two of you want something like this, one of you doesn't, and I think we just have to go, you know, one of you is just going to have to realize that you're just not going to get your way this time, but I'm hearing you. See, that's a whole different approach to authority, and you've got to be able to do that. One of the reasons why the ethnic churches lose their kids is because they're still maintaining authority as if you're not in an individualistic place. There needs to be more transparency, more communication, more persuasion. But you can still have authority, but it has to be wielded in a very different way. The churches have to be much more joyful, not just dour. The churches also have to not beat up on other churches. There's a whole lot of ways in which you can create communities that I think appeal to individualistic people and still be communities. It's still a struggle. And here's one last thing. The last thing is I think conservative Protestantism could really thrive if they learn how to reason better. Secondly, if they create those communities, people want communities and then they hate them. So they want them, but then they're so individualistic they can't stand them. And so there's a way of creating, but they want them. So you have to create communities that to some degree adapt, institutions to some degree adapt to an anti-institutional environment. You have to split the difference. Thirdly.
You mentioned your point about small groups.
What about them?
Well, you said the other night that.
Oh, yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, for example, we have 6,000 people coming. But we have about 3,000 people in small groups. If a person goes in the hospital, the group goes to see them, tells the pastor over them, tells me. So what I have said to people is, I said, if you come to my church and you're not in a small group and you go to the hospital and nobody knows about it, I don't want to hear it. I don't want to hear it. I said, unless you put yourself not just in this church community massive, but in a small community, you're not going to be on our radar. And I'm warning you right now, if you're not in one of those things, I don't want to hear it if I don't hear about it. So anyway, there's ways of doing it. There's one last thing, and that is I think Christians on sex and gender just need to lovingly challenge the culture to what's been called a wisdom contest. A wisdom contest. That's your first question, see, Sally. Now you can't ask any more. I want you to think. No. No.
Exclamation mark.
Well, okay. Here's a wisdom context is a proof in the pudding thing. You sit down and say, look, we have such radically different understandings of the purpose of sexuality and what gender is, so radical, that let's agree to this. And so we're going to create communities based on a couple of different assumptions about sex and gender. And let's give it 30 years. Let's just see what the outcomes of the children are. Let's see, you know, how people feel about the relationships. Let's just see. That's it. I mean, instead of arguing about it, you know, obviously, politically, whoever gets the most votes wins and gets public policy. But I do think there needs to be a kind of respect for the fact that we are now not so much a secular place as a polarized place. If we really do believe we're a pluralistic society, then we need to recognize there's different moral communities that are going to go at this thing differently, and we ought to kind of give goodwill to each other on those things, and then watch. And to some degree, the proof will be in the pudding. So I think if there's some of those things happen, I would say my belief is the conservative Protestantism will at least maintain its own, but probably could actually become a bigger party and a bigger player in the culture if some of those things happen. So that's it.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tim.
Can you ask?